Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, post-COVID pay cuts and Jay-Z's love chat. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Universal announced that it's bringing EMI Records back from the dead. It is reborn, they said. And if you believe the press release, this is probably the most monumental news to ever happen in the music industry.
Yes, according to the official confirmation that EMI Records is returning, was a load of hype about how EMI was the most important record label to have ever existed, certainly in the UK, possibly anywhere in the world. I mean, I suppose it was the British major record company, but the labels within the EMI group that surely were legendary was Parlophone right from way, way back in the day, and then I guess Virgin Records more recently. But yeah, they're bringing back EMI Records, although not only was the press release quite hyped, also, what they're actually doing is they're taking the division of Universal Music UK, currently known as Virgin EMI Records, and they're dropping the Virgin bit. So it's basically a nominal rebrand.
Yes, they're demoting Virgin, is what they should have said in the press release. They should have said, Virgin 50th anniversary is coming up, so we're demoting it because we did stuff for the 40th.
Yeah, and that doesn't actually seem that long ago. So Virgin Records will live on as an imprint of EMI Records, which is in itself a division of Universal Music UK. Actually, I don't think it's even happened yet. I think something probably went on behind the scenes because it all got announced. But if you go to their website, it still says Virgin EMI, and they were still putting out other press releases announcing new records coming out on Virgin EMI. So I think the announcement was a bit ahead of the actual rebrand occurring.
Yes, although the press release did say in its very hyped up tone, this is with immediate effect, nothing actually seems to have happened at all, except that just before this news came out, Virgin EMI boss Ted Cockle left the company.
Yes, and actually a big part of the EMI Records is Reborn press release was actually announcing that Rebecca Allen, who was previously boss of Universal's Decca division, so the slightly more classical jazzy side of the business, will now be heading up the all-new Reborn EMI Records. So big news this week, a division of Universal Music UK slightly changed its name. But as monumental as that development was, it's not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we will be discussing the lawsuit brought against Jay-Z and Beyoncé for stealing someone's voice. But first, a memo from Live Nation in the US last week outlined some of the changes the live giant says that it needs to make to its artist agreements once the live industry gets back into action after the COVID-19 shutdown, whenever that might be. This includes dropping artists' fees and guarantees by around 20% across the board and also asking artists to share more of the risk in putting on shows.
Yes. So although in many countries around the world, the COVID-19 shutdown continues, and while things are relaxing in most places, and obviously in England last week, all retailers on the high street were allowed to reopen. So things are very slowly returning to normal. Kind of interesting in the UK at the moment, isn't it? There was an article, either The Guardian or The Independent, I think The Guardian, it's quite an interesting article by someone saying it really feels in the UK at the moment that the population is split into 50-50. Half the population is still pretty much in lockdown, albeit with a little bit more flexibility than there used to be. And the other half has just given up and gone back to normal and isn't doing anything shut down. And obviously that depends slightly on whether or not your job allows you to work at home. But
I mean, we are in a weird situation now where you can't send your child to school, but you can take them to the zoo.
So although I think here in the UK, the rules are particularly confused, and obviously the rules are different all over the world, but in the main, there are still restrictions in place on live music in many, many countries around the world, even where restrictions have started to be lifted. Often that only applies to smaller events, or there are still physical distancing rules in place, which is why one of the things that's been happening in the last week is drive-in concerts and drive-in comedy shows, which I think people were kind of saying as a joke a month ago as being a possible way of overcoming physical distancing rules. They've started actually being announced. But my point is, although we are still in the midst of all of this and we don't know quite when we'll get back to something nearing normal, let alone full arena shows and festivals and everything being back up and running, nevertheless, the live music industry is looking ahead and saying, okay, let's be optimistic and assume that at some point in 2021, things are going to return to something like normal and venues are going to be open, tours are going to resume. We will have a festival season in 2021. What changes will we have to make? Partly due to the fact that the entire live industry has probably at best lost 6 months of income, and that could ultimately possibly end up being 12 months of income. Plus, until a vaccine is found, there's the constant fear that a second spike or a third spike or a fourth spike of COVID-19 could occur, which would then necessitate a whole load of new cancellations. So this is what this memo that came out of Live Nation, the biggest live music company in the world in the US, was all about last week. We knew that the big live music companies, that's mainly Live Nation and AEG, and the big booking agencies who represent the artists on the live side, had been in meetings in recent weeks talking about what happens once things resume. And we'd heard various rumours about what was being proposed. But we got to see some of those proposals actually in black and white once this memo leaked and was circulated all the way around. And some of it is to do with fees, some of it is to do with payment terms. But actually, probably a lot of the really interesting stuff in this memo was about who takes the risk once we're up and running again, given that there is always a chance that a second round of COVID shutdown could begin.
Yeah, so let's go through a few of those key points. So the big one is that artist guarantees in 2021 are likely to be around 20% lower than what had been agreed for 2020 shows. There are also changes to payment terms, which are likely to see artists paid a lot less money up front than they used to. The memo was really aimed at festivals, but we assume that it's kind of hinting at changes across the board in the future. I mean, one of the most interesting things in it was what it said about cancelled shows, which includes that if shows are cancelled due to poor ticket sales, possibly as a result of the ongoing concerns about going to live shows as a result of coming out of the COVID-19 lockdown, the artist would only get 25% of their fee. And when shows are cancelled due to unforeseen circumstances, such as, say, a global pandemic, the artist would get no fee at all, which is quite a shift to how things have been in the past. And that would also apply if physical distancing rules at shows make them unviable.
Yeah, so as you say, although there was lots of interesting things in this memo, I suppose not that many surprises, but some interesting stuff. But those cancellation terms being proposed were particularly interesting, yes. And I suppose it shows that one of the concerns for companies like Live Nation is that once everything swings back into action, until there is a vaccine, there are still going to be uncertainties, even once all of the official restrictions are lifted. Even if physical distancing rules ultimately get relaxed to almost being non-existent, there will remain uncertainties. Like, although a lot of the conversation to date has been about what the rule is in terms of physical distancing, is it 1 meter, is it 2 meters, is it 3 meters, is it 6 meters? Even if government officially says, okay, it's 48 centimetres, and the live industry says, okay, we can work with that. We can make our shows viable and still have 48 centimetres between each person in our venue. It's still not assured that once the tickets go on sale, anyone will buy the tickets. That is still to be tested. Is everybody really eager to get back out to shows? Or actually, are people going to be saying, do you know what? I'm going to wait and see. There has been some research on that, although most of the surveys published on that, actually the surveys were done relatively early in lockdown when we were in sort of the midst of the panic period of the pandemic. So you might find that the people who 2 months ago were saying, do you know what, I'm going to wait and see, actually are kind of changing their minds now and be like, no, I want to see some live music. But we don't know. So it could be that once we are allowed to start announcing shows again and we know that providing we can sell all the tickets, they're going to be viable shows, we might put the tickets on sale and it turns out nobody will buy the tickets. And it may well be that the fan bases for some artists are like, we don't care, we want to see the show. Fan bases for other artists, I guess particularly artists possibly with an older demographic, maybe more nervous. So in essence, what the live companies are saying here is we want to get shows on sale, we want to get tickets on sale, but there are so many unknowns. Plus, of course, there could be a second spike. Suddenly overnight, physical distancing rules could be reintroduced and we can't harbour the full risk on that. Even though in the live industry, traditionally, the promoter is the primary risk taker. That's what a promoter does. A promoter takes the financial risk on a show, then controls the tickets, makes the money back on selling tickets, and pays the artist their fee, their guarantee, and all of the other costs, etc. So it's kind of the live industry saying to artists, we can't be the primary risk taker. There is a parallel, if you think about it, with what happened in the mid-2000s when the record industry was in freefall and the value of recorded music was going down, down, down. And the record companies, who had traditionally made financial and marketing commitments with artists, which came with risks, particularly with new artists, where you didn't know whether that financial commitment and that marketing commitment would actually sell any records. But crucially, those risks have been exclusively secured around the sound recording revenue stream under a traditional record deal. That revenue stream then started to fall through the floor. And we started to see labels coming to artists and saying, well, if we're going to carry on taking these risks, we need to change the deal to justify the risk. And in that case, it was generally, we want to get a share of another revenue stream. We want to be cut into your ticket money or your publishing money or your merchandise money to justify it. And in a way, the live industry is saying a similar thing to its artists. It's saying, okay, we are the risk taker. We're happy to be the risk taker. But for various reasons, our risks have gone up, and therefore we need to change the deal, the arrangement, to allow us to continue taking those risks. There was actually some stuff in there also about things like sponsorship and merchandise and streaming rights. Now, to what extent they are actually changing what would be in a normal deal anyway is debatable. It also varies from country to country, but possibly that's a live sector saying we need some other ways of making money to justify this risk. But then, yeah, with all of those cancellation terms, they were seeking to spread the risk and saying to the artist, we've got these new risks in our business and you need to share those risks with us. And if it turns out the show can't happen, we can't be saddled with covering your guarantee, your fee for a show where we can't sell any tickets.
Yes, and there was one other cancellation term that we haven't mentioned yet. It says in the memo, if an artist cancels its performance in breach of the agreement, the artist will pay the promoter two times the artist fee. That's a pretty bold demand, and that's some of the risk shifting, I guess. And with that in mind, artists are now being told that they should get their own cancellation insurance, which is going to come at a time when, as a result of the pandemic, insurance premiums are going to shoot up. So that's going to be more risk and more cost to artists as we come out of this.
Yeah, and given that we know that while it is true that venues and promoters and ticketing companies, and Live Nation is all of those things, have really suffered in recent months, we also know that an awful lot of artists have really suffered in recent months when the live industry went into almost overnight shutdown. And as a result of that, I mean, Live Nation has taken some stick online since this memo was leaked, basically saying you're the biggest live music company in the world, you're quite a rich company, your senior executives are all incredibly well paid, you've got shareholders who pull money out of the business, therefore it's wrong for you as this big global corporate to be trying to push some of your risk onto the artists you work with, is what some of the critics have been saying.
Yeah, I spoke to one person in the live industry this week who said that it was undoubtable that practices in the business need to change as we come out of lockdown and we start to open up the live business again. But it was a bit rich that this was coming from Live Nation.
Yeah, as a very big, very rich company, although, nevertheless, a company with lots of liabilities, lots of buildings to run, lots of staff to carry on paying during shutdown and for all the months it will take.
I think it's worth mentioning that we've seen AEG, Live Nation's biggest rival, announce a lot more job cuts as the pandemic goes on, despite lots of efforts to kind of downsize things and weather the storm. It's clearly, while I think there was slightly tentatively optimistic talk initially, they're now facing a lot tougher times, particularly as we don't really know how long it's going to be before the live industry can really get back up to full or close to full capacity.
But as is always the way in debates and discussions and arguments like this, the devil is in the detail, because if you look at the live industry from an artist's perspective, live's such an incredibly top-heavy industry. And at the top with the Premier League artists, I mean, actually, the truth is, over the last 10 years, the agents representing those big artists have been pushing the fees up, up and up. And the big name artists have been getting ever increasing fees at the upper end. Now, That said, the artist has to cover certain costs for the show out of those fees, and some shows are very expensive to run, so just because the artist seems to be getting a massive fee on paper doesn't mean that they're making a huge profit. But I think a lot of promoters, and a lot of independent promoters, not just the Live Nations of this world, would argue that for the higher level artists, the agents have been pushing their fees up, 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 and with the festival sector as well. I mean, it's not unknown for all the ticket money from a festival to basically be spent on the headline acts, and everyone else having to be paid for out of the food and the drink and the sponsorship. So I think a lot of promoters would say, actually, for the bigger name artists, they have really pushed up their fees in recent years, which means there is a pretty substantial profit margin there. And therefore, given everybody is under pressure, it's only right that artists at that level should see a slight cut in the money that they're taking out of the pot, that they should be taking on more of the risks. And we're slightly repositioning the split of the money back towards the industry versus the superstar artists. And with the superstar artists, that is probably a legitimate argument to make. But as you work your way down the artist hierarchy, life becomes less lucrative. And in the middle, you'll have artists who make an all right living out of live, but only really wants the PRS money that comes in on the songwriter side because they're performing their own songs, and the merchandise money that comes in from the merch store. Only really once you put that with the ticket money or the fee does it become a viable, decent business. And there are plenty of people who are performing live who are just about breaking even and not taking particularly big fees out of it for themselves. So I suppose if these rules were applied completely across the board, the problem you would have is the big artists can certainly afford to take the cut and the extra risk. But then artists at the middle and towards the bottom, who have suffered the most as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, can't afford to take the cut, certainly couldn't afford to take on the extra risks. Now, we're not saying that Live Nation is planning to apply these rules completely across the board. This is a simple document that has been doing the rounds. And obviously, when artists perform tours and shows and festivals, every deal is different. Every deal is differently negotiated. Yes, promoters have their template agreements. Agents have their template agreements, and then a negotiation occurs and something in the middle is agreed. But I suppose that is the big concern from the agent side, from the manager side, from the artist side, is it's important to recognise that as you go up the live music hierarchy, which ultimately is based around the size of venues you're playing, there is a point at which actually there isn't much profit margin on the artist side. So what that means is any change to terms, any change to business practices has to have the flexibility in the system so that those who can afford to take the cut, those who can afford to saddle more risk, do so to help the industry get back up and running. But on the flip side, those artists for whom live is their primary revenue stream, but there isn't a huge amount of flexibility or profit margin in the live business of that artist, that they aren't put into a position where they can't afford to tour anymore.
Yeah, so it remains to be seen how this debate plays out ultimately, but it does seem certain that headliners at least are going to have to see a cut in their fees and an increase in risk in 2021 at the very least. Many promoters are probably hoping that this will be a shift that continues long term, but some agents are already saying that as things start to return to normal, we will see competition in the marketplace, and especially festivals ultimately swing things back closer to how they were before in favour of those artists who can shift a lot of tickets. And finally this week, Beyoncé and Jay-Z have been sued by choreographer and academic Dr. Lenora Steins, whose voice is heard at the start of Black Effect, the track on the couple's 2018 collaborative album Everything Is Love. Stein says that although she was working with Jay-Z and Beyoncé at the time she was recorded, she didn't know that a recording of her comments about what the word love means to her was being made, let alone that it would end up forming part of a track on their album.
Yes, so a lawsuit filed by Dr. Steins in the courts in Florida last week provided some context as to how she came to be working with Jay-Z and Beyoncé. Basically, in March 2018, they recorded a promotional video for the Everything Is Love album in Jamaica. She is based in Jamaica. She's a choreographer in Jamaica. So they had approached her to say, OK, we're doing this promotional video for the new album. We need some dancers to dance in that video. You're a local choreographer. Could you arrange some dancers for us? She did that. That's why she was sort of around when the promotional video was being recorded. And yeah, she said that during that project, at some point, Beyoncé, I think, had said to her, "What does the word love mean to you?" She then said some quite nice stuff about the word love and the different definitions of the word love. But as you said, she was not aware that what she was saying at that point was recorded. And the first that she knew that it had been recorded was when she heard the track Black Effect. And she noticed that the first fifth of the track is her talking about that word. In the lawsuit, it says that, I don't quite know how they know this, but the lawsuit says that as the defendants, so that's Beyoncé and Jay-Z, as they were leaving Jamaica, having recorded this promotional video, Jay-Z, obviously in the lawsuit, it says Sean Carter. So Carter, in capital letters for some reason, Carter, on information and belief, that's the legal way of saying this is the gossip we've heard on the grapevine. So Carter, on information and belief, was listening to various records that were intended to be featured on the album while he was flying back from Jamaica to the US. While listening to one of these records, Carter, on information and belief, indicated that one of the records, that's the record that became Black Effect, was missing something. Carter then directed an individual, presumably a sound engineer, it says in brackets, to add the recording of Dr. Stein's talking about the word love to the record. After the record was played for Carter, with Dr. Stein's recording added, Carter said something to the effect of, "That's it," says the lawsuit in explaining how her words ended up in the recording. Now, a big part of the lawsuit then talks about the fact that while she was with Jay-Z and Beyoncé as they recorded this promotional video, she did actually sign a contract. The assumption being that Jay-Z and Beyoncé and their team's response to this lawsuit is going to be, well, you signed a contract and we have the rights to use your voice as a result of that contract. So a big part of Dr. Stein's lawsuit talks about how that contract doesn't justify what Jay-Z subsequently did with the recording of her voice.
Yeah, she says in the lawsuit that she'd been forced to sign that contract by representatives of Beyoncé and Jay-Z, and she'd protested, said she didn't want to sign anything until a lawyer had seen it, but was told that it was just a standard contract and was needed in case footage of her appeared in the final edit of the video they were making.
Yeah, one of those classic, oh, it's just a standard contract, don't worry about it, you don't need to get a lawyer to look at it, just sign it, we need to do it now, we need to get all the admin sorted today, just sign it, just sign it, just sign it, is what she is saying. And she alleges she insisted that she wanted a lawyer to look at it. I think she says that her son is actually a lawyer in the US. So she said, well, can I just take a photograph of the contract and send it to him? And they were like, oh, no, it's all fine. It's nothing serious. And we need to get this sorted now, is what she's saying in this lawsuit. Obviously,
it's all just in case.
All just in case. Obviously, preempting Jay-Z and Beyoncé and their team coming back and saying, actually, this contract says we can record you and that we can use that recording. And she's basically saying, that contract isn't worth the paper that it is written on. And parts of this lawsuit use some pretty emotive language in explaining her upset and outrage when she first came across this track and realised this recording had been used, I guess partly to stress to the court. I mean, ultimately, she's pushing for a jury trial as to how this had a negative impact on her, and therefore she should be compensated for her voice being used in this recording, despite her not knowing A, that it was going to be used, or B, that it had even been recorded.
Yes, the lawsuit says, "To the shock, horror and chagrin of Dr. Stein's, Everything Is Love featured the unauthorised exploitation of her vocals on a song known as Black Effect. Dr. Stein's horror and chagrin was compounded when she realised that not only were her vocals featured on the recording, but she also discovered that she was not even credited by the defendants for providing her vocals. This discovery left Dr. Stein's feeling violated and as if the defendants had artistically raped her."
Yeah, very emotive language, particularly in that last sentence there. Elsewhere, the lawsuit talks about the fact that a significant portion of the track is her talking. I said earlier,
19.17%.
Exactly. I said earlier it was about a fifth. The lawsuit actually says that the first 60 seconds of the recording is her talking. The track is 5 minutes 13 seconds. So that means, yeah, 19.17, 2 decimal points. Of the recording are actually her voice. So the lawsuit is suing for copyright infringement, but also arguing that it had breached her publicity rights, a concept under American law, and also that there was unjust enrichment on the part of Beyoncé, Jay-Z, and their businesses.
As we record this, Jay-Z and Beyoncé have not responded, which is not really that surprising. Presumably behind the scenes, they are making moves to get this case dismissed. We'll see if a judge decides that Steins' case holds enough water that it can start to go through the court system. I think this would be a very interesting one if it got to court. But we have to give our usual caveat that they will almost certainly settle and this will never get to court. Possibly the next thing we hear about this will be the statement saying that both sides have agreed to dismiss in favour of an out-of-court settlement.
Yeah, you have to think, whatever was in the contract that she signed on that day back in March 2018, this is the kind of case where if it does go into court before a jury, I can't help thinking that Jay-Z and Beyoncé wouldn't come out very well. Whatever the actual legalities are of the contract that she signed, they probably wouldn't come out of that looking very good. And of course, that always provides a much bigger incentive to write a cheque, make good, and get the whole thing kicked out of the legal arena.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason that the initial lawsuit has such emotive language. Part of the point here is to paint Jay-Z and Beyoncé in such a bad light that even if they think that she's wrong, they don't really want to discuss it anymore. And if what she's really looking for is credit and payment for her involvement in that record, then that's a lot easier to hand over and, in PR terms, possibly a lot better than pulling her into a long, drawn-out case.
So to conclude, we now await the statement saying that this has been settled out of court.
And everyone's happy. But we're not going to sit here and wait with you because that is all we have time for this week on Setlist. If you want more episodes, we put them out every week. But we've got a whole back catalogue and not all of them are about current news. We've got lots of episodes about things that have happened in the history of the music industry if you go back through our archive. So why not go and do that while you're waiting for a statement from Jay-Z and Beyoncé? If you want to get more of these, make sure you subscribe. If you liked it, make sure you rate and review it. And if you've got anything to tell us, you can find us on social media. You can email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. And yeah, I'm sure we'll talk to you, so that'll be nice. If not, you can hear our voices again next week, as I think I've made clear. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moult and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.